Hello, microbe friends. I'm Dr. Justine Dees, and welcome to the Joyful Microbe Podcast. It's the show all about the microbes we encounter in our daily lives. Thank you so much for tuning in. I can't wait to share this show with you. Plastic waste is a huge problem, especially in our oceans. But here's something fascinating. Certain bacteria might actually have the answer. Did you know that there are bacteria out there that can degrade plastic? Plastic pollution not only impacts wildlife, but it can also find its way into our food and water. With plastic production on the rise, it's crucial to find better ways to handle this material. Unfortunately, our current recycling methods aren't cutting it. Most plastic ends up in landfills or the environment after just one use, and it can linger there for centuries. But here's where it gets exciting. Researchers are diving deep into the world of plastic-degrading microbes. These little microbes have this amazing ability to break plastic down into its basic parts, which could revolutionize recycling as we know it. Today, I'm joined by Angie Beckett, a researcher from the University of Portsmouth, to explore the potential of these plastic-eating microbes. We'll dive into how they work, their potential for large-scale applications, the challenges involved, and how cutting-edge DNA sequencing is helping us discover new microbial solutions. Stick around as we discuss the incredible promise of microbes in tackling plastic pollution and enhancing recycling efforts. All right, let's get on to the interview. Hi, Angie. Thanks so much for coming on the Joyful Microbe Podcast.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you on today to discuss the exciting potential of plastic degrading microbes. But first, I'd love to hear your story. So how did you get interested in microbiology, and what was your path to becoming a microbiology researcher?
Well, for me, you know, when I was younger, I never really imagined that I'd be a scientist. I don't think I even knew that that was an option growing up. No one in my family had like been to uni or had professional jobs, but I guess I ended up there by following my interests. Originally, like I thought I would want to do a PhD. Originally, I thought I wanted to do A-levels in psychology, and I kind of threw biology on as my last option. But in the end, I really fell in love with biology at A-level and decided, okay, well, this is the thing that interests me the most, so I'm going to do this for my degree. And then when I did my degree, the topics that kind of interested me the most then were microbiology. I guess this understanding of like how things work and the fascination of things that are so small having such a big impact upon us. And it was then that I decided I would learn more about that by doing a master's in medical microbiology. And then it's just sort of gone on from there. So yeah, I just kept picking the things that I enjoyed doing the most.
Yeah, that makes sense. Following your passion and love for science. And it's interesting that you ended up switching from psychology into microbiology, but that's very cool.
Yes. I guess sometimes some people really know what they want to do early on. And I really admire those people, but it's been a very different path for me. And I think you don't really know what you like until you start having a go. So I guess you can just kind of learn as you're doing it.
So how did you end up in your current position? And can you tell us a little bit about what you do there?
Yes. So I used to work in industry, making vaccines and things. But then I saw a position at my local university, and I really wanted to have a go at working in academia, because I knew that maybe there'd be a lot of confidence that came from like planning my own experiments in a different way, a greater sense of freedom than I had in industry that I wanted. And I started right at the beginning of the pandemic. So it was a little bit of a troubling time. And I was hired to do this job on plastic degradation, the idea being that there are bacteria in the environment which had the capability of breaking down plastic. And it's my job to discover them so that we can then go on to engineer them and make them better and ready for use in industry.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, and I think that we all realize that plastic's a problem in our world today because it's so difficult to biodegrade. But can you explain the scope of the problem of plastic and the significance of plastic pollution?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I'm sure you all know, that we have to dig up oil and gas to make plastic. And the problem is, because it's built for longevity and it lasts so well that now it's polluting our environment. So approximately 8 to 12 million tons of plastic end up in the ocean every year. And I'm sure by now most people have heard of microplastics. And I guess what's happening here is the mechanical action of the waves and the UV light exposure from sunlight is breaking that plastic down, but it's not breaking it down chemically, it's breaking it down physically into smaller and smaller chunks, and those chunks are making their way through the food chain. So in that sense, it's having a big impact on pollution. And the kind of cause of this, you know, it release into the environment, I think kind of originates in the fact that only about 10% of plastic is recycled. So a lot of it ends up being processed in ways that are not good for the planet. Either it makes its way into the environment or it makes its way into landfill, or in some places you might incinerate your waste. But if that's the case, you're still going to be releasing carbon dioxide into the environment. So it's not good all around. It's very helpful for our lives, but it is having an impact.
Yeah, it's that definitely. And talking about microplastics too, that's like, just seems like it's an even scarier problem. But it turns out that there are these plastic degrading microbes out there, which is pretty incredible. It seems like microbes always find a way to deal with whatever is out there. Some microbe is able to take advantage of that and fill that niche. So, but how did scientists initially discover that microbes could degrade plastic?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I love the way that they've adapted. So essentially what's happened is plastic is so common in the environment now that some bacteria have evolved to use it as a nutrient source. They release the carbon in it and they use that to fuel their own growth. And the first team to discover this were a team in Japan, and they were in a recycling center and they discovered a bacteria there that can break down plastic. Now, it might seem unusual that bacteria can break down plastic, but it's kind of evolved from this mechanism they already have in place. And that is the capability to break down plants. So if you imagine when your leaves are composting, that process is a process of breaking down. And similarly, when plants want to invade a leaf to infect it, they need to break it open. And the mechanism by which they do that, the enzyme they use to break that down, is very similar to the enzyme that breaks down plastic. So it just so happens that the structure of the natural polymer or the natural material in nature, so this like waxy cutin, which is the coating on leaves that makes water run off of them. So if you imagine like running your cabbage under the tap, the water sort of pools and drops straight off. That material is what the bacteria have to break down in order to infect them or break them down into compost. And the structure of that is very similar to the structure of plastic chemically. So it didn't take too much of a leap for it to be able to change from one thing to the next.
Huh. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's, well, in a way, I guess it kind of makes sense, you know, thinking about plants, but and that it would be similar. But, you know, at the same time, I would have never thought of that.
Yeah, and that's what makes it kind of important to, you know, if we discover this plastic degrading enzyme, this plastic degrading bacteria, we can't release this solution into the ocean to break down all the plastic that already exists, because it could also break down the plant life that exists there. So we have to kind of be careful in the way we do it. What we want to do is not release it into the environment. We want to improve the way that we recycle. I don't think a lot of people realize that in current recycling, it's very inefficient. So each time you recycle plastic, you lose some quality. And eventually your plastic water bottle might end up as like a cheap carpet, but eventually it will end up in landfill anyway. And I think at the most you would get about 6 cycles out of plastic recycling before the quality is so bad it's unusable. Whereas the mechanism, the way in which bacteria break down this plastic, it breaks it down into its original building blocks, which allows us to recycle infinitely. And if we can recycle infinitely without a loss of quality, then we no longer need to make more fresh plastic. So we're stopping that initial like digging up of oil in the first place. And we're trying to keep stuff out of the environment in a better way because we have a more efficient solution.
Yeah. Well, and that's a really important point, that the byproducts of the microbial process are different from the plastic waste from traditional recycling methods. Can you get a little more specific about the building blocks that are left over after the microbes break down the plastic?
So with regards to the building blocks, they're literally like Lego blocks of plastic that you can use to make more plastic. So there's no loss there. Sometimes there will be byproducts of the industrial process. However, when you have an industrial process, it's in the interest to make it as efficient and cost-effective as possible. So the byproducts that get made during this industrial process would be utilized for other things. So the idea is to have a perfect cycle where nothing is wasted.
So you have building blocks that would go into making plastic. And then like, what is the plastic waste from recycling methods? Like, how does that compare to the building blocks that remain?
I guess maybe what's better to focus on is the complete reusage of the plastic building blocks, which would be a waste product from normal recycling, which therefore means that you're creating more pollutants in that sense, because if you're downcycling each time and getting worse quality, then your waste product is some of your plastic. Whereas with this method, the waste itself, that plastic waste doesn't exist because it's all being reincorporated into like more plastic.
Yeah.
If you can infinitely recycle, then you're not making fresh plastic and you're producing high quality plastic each time. So the whole process becomes better in terms of we're not creating new plastic, and the plastic we have, we're recycling efficiently rather than inefficiently. And the more efficient it is, the more likely we are to reach above this 10% capacity. And I can't remember what the products are from the process, but I have read a paper on it. And they're not pollutants. They're things that can be used in other industrial processes. But I don't know how that compares to what comes out of the current recycling method.
But it seems to be things that are like more sustainable than what comes out of the traditional recycling methods.
I mean, it's the whole thing's more sustainable by the fact that it's infinite. So it's not, you're not creating something, you're not having this short lifespan, and you're not creating toxic byproducts because your plastic is all getting utilized, your building blocks.
Yeah. And that's really the point I was trying to get to, is that it's you know, it doesn't really matter like what the products are. I mean, it matters to the environment, but to us, it's like the specific products. It's the concept of that you have an infinite process versus a process that's limited.
Yes. So I think that's really cool. You know, when if you're using, and the idea is to use everything that comes out of that process. So there is no, you could say that there is no wasteful byproduct in this process because there's not something that's just going to bin to get incinerated as a true waste. All the waste will be utilized in some other industrial process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's really great.
I guess in that sense, the most important thing is just good quality product versus lower quality product each time.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the crux of the process. The byproducts are like a minimal part of the selling point of this like method, if you know what I mean. Really the essential bit is just the fact that it's infinite and there's no loss of quality, because that is pretty game changing for the industry itself.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, we should probably dive more into who's involved in this. So what specific types of microbes can degrade plastic and what gives them the ability to do this?
Well, the types of bacteria that break down plastic really vary. And there's even some fungi that do it. And what causes that capability is normally the fact that they had some past life where they wanted to chew away at leaves and break them down. But just because you're able to break down a leaf doesn't mean you've naturally decided to adapt to breaking down plastic. And really, it's our job to discover those bacteria in the environment. The most famous one is the one from Japan, which I talked about earlier, that was called Aedinella sakaiensis because it was discovered in Sakaiensi in Japan. However, there are many, many types of bacteria that have this capability if we can find them. And the way we're going about finding them is using a process called DNA sequencing. And the way I explain this is, you know how we all have our own DNA fingerprints. And sometimes if somebody is very sick, for example, you would do a genetic test to see which gene they have that's causing this symptom. It's the same with these plastic degrading bacteria. We take a whole load of samples from the environment, and then we look at the DNA fingerprints of all the bacteria we find there, and we look for genes that cause plastic degradation, so plastic degrading genes rather than disease causing genes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the DNA that we're interested in. We have to confirm this in a lot of different ways, because one answer doesn't always mean there's definitely the potential for plastic degradation. So initially, yes, we look at the genetic fingerprint, this very long DNA barcode that each of us have and the bacteria have too. And the sequence of these different letters that make up our DNA is understood using a process called sequencing, and that's how we find it out. So first of all, we look at the DNA fingerprints and we think, okay, do they have plastic degrading genes or not? And if they do have these genes, then we would take those bacteria and we would grow them on Petri dishes, agar plates, with some plastic in it. And then you could look for zones of clearance. So areas where the bacteria have clearly been eating the plastic and caused, you know, you can actually see like a color change in the agar itself. So that's nice and easy to spot. So that's a good confirmation test in the beginning. But if you imagine when you have these bacteria in the environment, they're working really slowly because they're not in a big rush. And they're working at cool temperatures, like what we would have, you know, maybe 20 degrees or 15 degrees outside. It depends where you are. Some places are warmer than others, obviously. But in order for it to work for industry, we need it to be cheaper than the current recycling methods, which means it needs to be quicker and more efficient. You know, we can't be waiting weeks to break down some plastic. It needs to take days or even hours would be better. And industrial processes, by their nature, happen at very high temperatures. And so we need to make them better at working at high temperatures. And that's done by our engineering team. So we have people that discover the bacteria first, and then people that enhance them and make them better by using engineering. So they kind of cut and paste pieces of DNA in and out to make them more productive for industry.
Oh, well, that's really interesting. I hadn't considered that they would be, yeah, I was wondering about how long it takes, but like the plastic degrading microbes versus natural degradation or just like the breakdown in nature. But yeah, so it sounds like this process varies based on if the microbes are degrading the plastic in nature compared to the way that we would really like them to to be able to. Do you have an idea of the timing for that, like in nature versus what we're aiming to achieve in an industrial scale?
In nature, it can take, you know, weeks. And in the labs here at Portsmouth, the engineering team have developed a PETase, which is an enzyme that can break down PET plastic water bottles within hours.
Oh, wow.
We still need to grind down the plastic first into small pieces to make that easier. And I think it's also worth noting that when you scale up to industry, you're adding a new challenge again, which is in nature, maybe you discover like one little piece of plastic to chew on, whereas in an industrial process, there's going to be loads of it crammed in together. So you need to be able to work with these really high plastic loads as well.
Mm.
And on top of that, the current solutions that we're finding are really targeted towards PET at the moment, which is this polyethylene tetraphthalate, which sounds really complicated, but that's just the name of the plastic we use to make our water bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you imagine with that kind of plastic, what makes it really good for being a container for drink, which is something we're going to consume, is that it's very chemically non-reactive because we don't want anything dangerous leaking into our drink that we then swallow, right? But it's that non-reactivity that makes it so hard to break down, which is why it's lasting so long in the environment. But PET happens to be one of the easier plastics to break down because of its chemical structure. But other plastics like PVC that you'd have in your windows or PU, or there's so many polyethylene, polypropylene, they all have these long, boring names, but some are much harder to break down than others. And the solution for one type of plastic might not necessarily be the solution for all of them. And that's a big challenge for the whole industry and something that people face as a challenge even today with the current recycling methods, which is the challenge of mixed waste. So in an ideal world, if you want to be very efficient, then you would have all the different types of plastic in one big pool together and the solution would be able to deal with all of them at once. But if you've got some that are really hard to break down than others that need different solutions, then that makes the thing more complicated. So in an ideal world, we would find something that's capable of breaking down even the hardest things and that's not disrupted by some contamination. For example, I'm sure you're all aware that you're supposed to be rinsing out your cans and your bottles before they go into your recycling bin, but how many people do that effectively remains to be seen. And you know, those things can all get in the way of a process later down the line. So there's lots of factors to consider. And I think it's also worth saying that we're not necessarily going to grow lots of bacteria in a big vat and chuck some plastic in there. What normally happens with these things is you grow the bacteria and they secrete this enzyme, which means they push it outside of their body, outside their cell wall, into the environment. And what would happen is you would grow loads of bacteria, let them push this enzyme, this mechanism for breaking down plastic out. And then at the end of the process, you would filter out all the bacteria, keep the enzyme and purify it so it's nice and clean. And then that's what you would attach then to your recycling, because you don't really want loads of bacteria mixed in with your plastic that you then want to go and make more food and drink packaging and bottles with.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the enzymes then? Because presumably you wouldn't want them left over. So there must be like a purification process, I guess, to separate the products from the enzyme.
Absolutely, yeah. There will be a way to separate them at the end. It's just easier when there's not bacteria involved well.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. But it does seem like there's got to still be that, the process of getting rid of the enzyme too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. And that also just the idea of that it's even possible to use these enzymes apart from the bacteria, and that all comes down to the fact that the bacteria, like you said, they're secreting the enzymes outside of themselves, which is really interesting. It's almost like this, they digest things outside of their bodies, which is very different from the way that we eat our food.
Yes. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah. I guess the only thing that we do that's similar to that is that we process our food before we eat it. That's true. Hey there. It's me, Justine, founder of Joyful Microbe. Guess what? I'm not just passionate about spreading microbiology joy through my podcast. I'm also interested in helping others create engaging scientific content. As a freelance science writer and editor with a PhD in microbiology, I bring a blend of scientific expertise and effective communication. No need to hire two people to get the job done. I've got it all covered. If you love what I've created on Joyful Microbe, imagine what we can do together for your project. Whether you're a life science company or an academic and need compelling content, I'm here to help. If you've got something in mind and want to chat about it, send me an email at justine@justinedees.com or check out my website, justinedees.com. Let's turn your ideas into awesome science content. Can't wait to collaborate with you. Now back to the show. But that's not done by enzymes from our bodies.
No.
So you and your team have discovered these bacteria that can degrade plastic, but are you still searching for more bacteria that can degrade plastic more efficiently that you wouldn't have to engineer as much?
Yeah, absolutely. We're still looking, and it could be either that we don't need to engineer them as much. Yes. So it could be either finding bacteria that break down these difficult plastics that we don't have an answer for yet, or we could be going to areas where, for example, the bacteria have adapted to heat. So for example, taking samples from warmer climates so that we could then find bacteria that are better capable at working at high temperatures. And there's a few ways of doing this. And one way that I'm working on at the moment is a method for scanning the environment for areas of interest. So the way I'm approaching that is a little bit how when you go on an archaeological dig, you want to put all the work and effort and money into digging up a site when you know that there's something there to begin with, rather than just having this needle in the haystack problem where you're randomly guessing where might be an area of importance. And the way that I'm doing that scanning method is by using this really special technique developed by Oxford Nanopore, and it's a method of sequencing. And what's really cool about the machine that they've developed is traditional machines are really big. They take up a lot of space in the lab and they cost tens of thousands of pounds. So they're heavy and not very portable, and you need a lot of money to even get started. But the ones that this company developed is the size of a stapler, and it's completely portable. So for example, people have taken it to the International Space Station and they've taken it to the Arctic, where the most northern part you can get to, or the most southern part of the globe that you can get to the middle of the ice caps, and looked for bacteria to see what's present there. Mm-hmm. It's been to all different places. And we're trying to use that method in the field to scan for areas of interest before we go back and do our more in-depth, expensive testing, because the ability to look at something in depth takes a lot of computing power and a lot of sequencing power, which can make it quite costly, because in a lab, maybe you would grow something out on an agar plate and you would take maybe one individual type of bacteria, and it wouldn't be very hard to look at the DNA for that. But if you imagine in the environment, there's millions and billions of bacteria all packed into a really tight space. So when you just take a sample from the environment, it's like 20 different puzzles all jumbled together, and you need to get a lot of information to be able to sort those back out into their original piles. But that's the method we're using at the moment, which is really cool because we get to just go to different sites. At the moment, we're going in our local area to see if we can find anything of interest, and then we can further take those forward to the engineering team after that. It's kind of like a nice pipeline here. So we discover something, we give it to our engineering team who make it better, and then they give it to the deployment team who make it fit for industry.
That's so cool. I think it's amazing that there's now these nanopore sequencers that you know, they're just making sequencing accessible, and you can do it from anywhere. What would be the advantage of sequencing on site versus taking the samples back to the lab?
The advantage is, well, sometimes you don't have a lab. So, for example, nanopore sequencing was used in the pandemic and also during the Ebola outbreaks in Africa, where they maybe didn't have big lab settings where it was even possible to do that testing. Mm. So you could easily get to a remote village and find out which variant people had and what was going on and track transmission. So in that sense, it's really important. And sometimes getting your sample back from where it is to your lab, it could like die along the way, or, you know, I'm sure many people are aware that when you culture bacteria on a Petri dish, you can only get about 5% of what's actually in the environment. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to do that in real time in the place that you've discovered it, rather than trying to grow it on a plate for weeks and missing like 90% of it. I know that they want to sequence, you know, when you're sequencing in the International Space Station, I guess there's like not a lot of room. So having something small and portable is a lot easier than what they were doing before, which was sending their samples back down to Earth for testing.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like it matters when it's a time sensitive sort of situation, but also when the organisms themselves may not, you know, be that portable.
I was going to say, you know, there are benefits to doing it in the lab as well. You know, it's very easy to look at which species are present when you're in the environment. But if you really want to deep dive into the mechanisms of which genes are present and all that kind of stuff, it's normally better done in the lab, because maybe you need to run that sample for 24 hours to get enough data to make those decisions. So it's not that portability is the answer for everything either.
Yeah, that makes sense, of course. So and you mentioned, I mean, that only, I think, did you say 5%? I know it's a really small amount, actually, of organisms, like microorganisms, can grow on Petri dishes. And that's why sequencing has been such an amazing development for understanding microbiology. So does this ever become an issue with the plastic degrading bacteria that you find? Like, are they ever difficult to grow in the lab? And then if another thing that came to mind was, as far as secreting the enzymes, are there any times when it's difficult to figure out how to get them to secrete the enzymes? I just wonder, how hard are they to work with?
Yeah, they're not that easy to work with. Some are better than others, but we have a really brilliant PhD student in our lab, and she's been working on growing this Idinella strain that was from Japan. And she has struggled in that they take weeks and weeks and weeks to grow. So it's a very slow process. Whereas like E. coli or something that we're used to working with maybe would grow within 24 hours. So then you're working with something that grows really slowly. That's quite difficult. And also if you want to look at how plastic grow on bacteria and on plastic, and you're only giving them plastic as a nutrient source because you want to take away all other nutrients, so there's only plastic left, so that when they grow, you know, it's because they can break down plastic and not just because they're using the other stuff that's present in the media. By the time you're doing that, you're kind of stressing them out a little bit because you're basically starving them and giving them one food option and seeing what happens. So in that sense, they're difficult to work with from the microbiological side. And similarly, you're right, some bacteria create enzymes that could break down plastic, but they never secrete them, so you wouldn't see. And that's something that the engineering team have difficulty with. So obviously, you have the original bacteria that produce these enzymes, but what you can do is genetically engineer other bacteria that are faster growing to produce your enzyme in a higher quantity to make them into little manufacturing machines that can count the thing you want. So sometimes on paper, like when you look on, when you look at the DNA and you look computationally, the enzyme looks like it's going to be amazing. But then when you try and stick that into E. coli or something to manufacture loads of that enzyme, sometimes it just never comes out of the cell. And at that point, you have to, the engineers who are very good either have to figure out a way to induce the expression, so to induce the release of the enzyme from the bacterial cell. But other times it just doesn't work, and they have to, it could be, it could have great potential, but if it doesn't work, then that's it. It can't be taken any further forward.
Wow. Yeah. I think I remember learning about this with biofuels. We had at a journal club in during my PhD where we talked about making biofuels, and it was like the same, you know, they experienced the same issues with the organisms. But yeah, that's tricky. First, like you have these slow growing organisms. I feel like that's how it usually is. Is that like the organism that makes this like incredible gene, or you know, set of genes that can do this process that we really want to take advantage of, it's like quite often they're in these organisms that are just really tricky to work with. But then you try to move it, and then it's like the process doesn't even work the way that you're expecting it to. And I just wonder, like, there must be other genes involved, that it's just, there's so much more that goes into understanding these organisms to actually use them in any really like realistic way at the industrial scale.
Yeah, I mean, biology is so complicated, and it's like you said, it never goes smoothly. But there are people using enzymatic recycling at an industrial plant in France. So it's happening. It is happening in reality as we speak.
And oh, that's cool.
That gives a lot of hope for work for the future. So It is possible, and I'm sure that with many minds, because you know the University of Portsmouth aren't the only people globally that are looking into this. Between us all, I'm sure we will find the solutions and start to find a way to tackle this difficult problem. But really, it's what's kind of fascinating about these applied problems, you know, these real world problems, as opposed to maybe traditional research where you can just have your one specialism that you focus on. A big cross-disciplinary project requires people with very different series of expertise. It needs a lot of collaboration, which is a really good thing, because you know, complex problems need complex solutions. And even though that's a challenge for this type of research, because maybe you can only do one step of the process before you have to give it to somebody else, and again for the next step after that. I just think collaboration in science is so important. So it's a good thing that it happens this way, but it also poses its challenges as well.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. It's true. Collaboration in any application of the word, it's like collaboration, it usually brings about things that you would never expect, but then it's also comes with challenges, like you said, but it is so important. And I love seeing scientific collaborations, and I got to do lots of cool different collaborations when I was in school. So it's like you get to learn so much from the people that you work with, but then new ideas form that would have never had different people come together to work on a problem together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so important to understand as a scientist that you're not expected to do everything, and it's not actually physically possible to be an expert in everything. We're really, we're really lucky here at Portsmouth because we have this center where we have all three, we have the scientists dedicated to all three sections. Whereas I think in some places, the expertise they have is able to do the first bit, and then they would have to find external collaborators to help with the second or third part of that process. But thankfully, we're on a little hub here, which makes life a little bit easier for us.
So I'm curious, you mentioned that there is somewhere in France where they're doing this, like in real life. Yes. I wonder, do you know much about that? Like, because it seems like if it's being done somewhere, like, why can't we all just do the same process?
Yeah, why can't we all have it, right? Yeah, the company that do that are called CarBios. And I guess the reason not everyone's doing it is probably that, you know, it's owned by industry. And like with all things like that, it's not open access knowledge. You know, they have their enzymes that they've developed that they're using in their industrial plant. And that's their kind of intellectual property, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's up, you know, just in the way that there's loads of different people manufacturing the same thing in slightly different ways. It's going to be the same with this sort of process. But there is a consortium of people from across the globe. It's called the Bottle Consortium, who are like coming together to make sure that the research they do is not being replicated where it doesn't need to be. So they're kind of all working, figuring out a way to work together so that we're not like repeating ourselves. Two people are working on the same thing at the same time, like unnecessarily. So there are lots of people that are invested in working together and finding joint solutions.
Yeah. Very interesting. I guess that makes sense. Do you have anything about your work or microbiology in general that you think many people misunderstand or that you'd like to clear up?
I think for me, you know, kind of touching on what we spoke about earlier, is that I used to believe that to be a good scientist, I had to be able to do everything myself. And so maybe I didn't put myself forward for opportunities, or I had a lot of doubts about whether I'd be capable of doing that role. And now I kind of understand that every job I've had, I've done a completely different subject area. So maybe the only skill they really want is that I know how to research a problem and figure it out, and that I know how to troubleshoot when something goes wrong. And the technicalities, like the small details of the process, is something I can learn on the job. And I think before I just felt scared that I needed to know everything before I started, which was quite daunting and overwhelming at the time. And now I kind of realize
that,
you know, it's not really too much of a problem.
Yeah. Oh, I relate to that.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah, I definitely remember feeling that way. And I still feel that way sometimes. It's like you have to just remember that you're not expected to know everything. And like you said before about collaboration, it's like there's so many people involved, and that's how we solve these problems, because it is really difficult for one person to know everything and solve the issue by themselves.
Yeah, I think as well, people don't talk about failure enough in science as well. You know, obviously experiments fail. Sometimes I have 10 months worth of work that goes in the bin, but it's more than that. I think it's easy to see these like professors or big managers, you know, big team leads in industry, and you see all the successes, or maybe you see on you know, LinkedIn or other social media that everyone's doing super well, but no one talks about all the things that went wrong in the middle. And yeah. I've broken equipment and I've made mistakes that I shouldn't have just because I daydreamed for 2 seconds when I didn't need to do that. And I've embarrassed myself asking the wrong questions and the right questions. And you know, it's really a part of the process. And you know, it's really uncomfortable being a scientist because you're always having to learn new things. So you're always a little bit feeling like you don't know enough, and that it's not going right, and someone else is maybe able to do it better. But really, no one can do it better. As long as you're willing to have a go, then that's enough. So don't think that everyone else has it together, because I mess up all the time.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think when I started working on my PhD, I came in thinking I'm expected to know everything. And, you know, you hide, if you like make a mistake, you try to just like do it over again, but not like tell everybody about it. And it's like I'm not saying that I like hid my bad things that I did or anything, but it's like I felt like if I messed up an experiment, I would just have to like go and do it again, but I wouldn't go telling everybody about it. And mm-hmm. it's like, you know, for new students, it makes it appear as though everything is going smoothly. And they just assume like, oh yeah, they're just perfect. And it's like, no, nobody's perfect. And we all make mistakes, and really failure leads to so much progress, as counterintuitive as that is. It's like you have to fail to appreciate when something is done right and to learn why something is right, and you just understand everything so much better once you've like messed it up.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. This idea that it's easy to fail and then not talk about it and then go and fix it quietly, and is something I had a really big habit of doing for like many years, because I was really ashamed of my failures and the times when I messed up, and I thought if people don't find out about it, then it's like it didn't happen, I can just fail on my own time. And now I try to be more honest and open when I mess up, like on a daily basis, weekly basis. I try and share more often when I make my mistakes to kind of help create a culture and make other people feel comfortable about admitting their mistakes, because it's not easy to admit your mistakes in a culture of like shaming and blaming. So I guess it depends on the environment you're in, whether right. it's safe to do that. But it definitely makes me feel better when I talk about them than when I keep them to myself now. Because then normally someone else says, oh yeah, I messed up this thing last week too. And then everyone starts confessing and you realize that you're all in the same boat.
Yeah. And also as a leader, you know, if someone has a lab, they can create that sort of environment. And then as someone who works under someone, you can know that you're not stuck, because there are going to be leaders out there that will create that sort of environment for you. So if you have a job and you work under someone that doesn't create that sort of environment, you can find it.
Yeah, it is out there.
Yeah. So when it comes to microbiology, though, what have you learned overall from your work that's changed how you think about microbes in your daily life?
I would say, you know, that we have more microbes in our body, like microbial cells, than we have human cells. And actually, the world is run by microbes, which I didn't really realize before. I'd heard of bacteria and I knew that they like impacted our lives. But really, I think what I've learned from microbiology is that they rule our lives, and they're just very quiet about it. So we don't always understand just how much control they have over us.
Yeah, even over like the foods that we eat.
Exactly.
Our cravings and things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what at-home microbiology activity can you tell us about so we can experience the microbial world in a hands-on way?
So we have this activity which is really about understanding DNA sequencing and what it means to discover plastic degrading bacteria. And what we do is we take little eggs, you know, like the ones you get in your Kinder Egg ones, or you could make them out of egg cartons, and they represent bacteria. You could even decorate your bacteria and give them some personalities if you wanted to. And within each bacteria, we have a little color code chart, which is a series of blocks in different colors that represent the different genes that that bacteria contains in its DNA fingerprint. Essentially, you would take a egg cup at random, a bacteria at random, break it open to release the DNA code. You can build that sequence out of Lego if you wanted. So you can match the building blocks with real building blocks. And then you take it to a key and you match it up the color codes from the DNA that you've broken open to the key that you have to discover whether your bacteria is a plastic degrading one or not.
Yeah, I love that. That's really,
yeah, it's quite
cool.
Good fun. It's always nice when you have Lego involved as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Thank you for sharing that. Do you have any resources that you recommend so listeners can go deeper on this topic?
I think in terms of resources, I can recommend like some articles. Something recently came out in The Guardian here, actually, a newspaper article on plastic eating bacteria and enzyme recycling waste. And we also have a nice little YouTube video that we recorded at the university that explains the process of breaking down plastic into its building blocks that could be of use. So I share that with you if that's helpful.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, those will be great. And so where can everyone find, follow, and connect with you?
Everyone can find me on LinkedIn or on Twitter. So please get in touch.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we'll link to those in the show notes. So, Angie, thank you so much for sharing all of this information about plastic degrading bacteria. This has been so fascinating. We've touched on a lot of different topics today. So I really appreciate your time.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed chatting with you. And yeah, look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Joyful Microbe Podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you'd like to help others who love microbes to find the podcast, then please leave a rating and a review for the show. And tell a friend. To learn more about the Joyful Microbe, head on over to joyfulmicrobe.com, where you will find the show notes and all the links and resources mentioned. If you love Joyful Microbe and would like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a virtual tip through Ko-fi. The link is in the show notes and on joyfulmicrobe.com at the bottom of the page. Thanks again, microbe friends. Talk to you next time.